Welcome to ARM's Let's Talk Solutions podcast. I'm your host, Hunter Pettis, and in this podcast, we're going to talk about solutions to risks, hazards, and issues that matter to our ministries. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Solutions, where we dive deep into the world of strategic risk management. Today, I am your host, Hunter Pettis, manager of the Risk Control Department, and I have the privilege of having conversation with our very own risk control specialist, Brian Schwab. We will focus on the basics. Risk management a lot of times can get pretty complex as you learn more about how to protect your ministry, your facilities, and even your congregation. It's a field that is rapidly evolving and can become challenging at times. But we know that once we have a rock solid foundation, it goes a long way. So I kind of just want to dive right into it. Again, thank you, Brian, for joining me with in this conversation to spend some time talking about extensions of declarations and statement of values. You know, so thank you for joining. And let's kind of
thank you, Hunter. Thank you, Hunter. It's a privilege to be here.
Absolutely. I know we work closely together. It's always great to have these conversations, and we spend a lot of time in risk management on the daily. So there's a lot of things that our audience may not see as often as we would. So kind of go line by line item by line item for some of our listeners and viewers. You'll on an annual basis receive what's called a declaration. Extension of declarations or statement of values from either your account executive or some cases it'll come directly from the conference. And what that document entails is your coverage limits, your location, square footage, construction type. And all of these are some of the things that we'll actually kind of walk through. Brian, I'm sure you have more experience than I do in some instances, and even some stories to share about what you've seen out in the field and what actually ends up being on some declarations of or statements of value sometimes.
Yeah, I sure do. Where would you like to start, Hunter, today on the statement of values? Do you want to start on the description part of it or?
Yeah, so I think we can just go straight from the top. So, I mean, when you're looking directly at the statement of values, the first thing you see is the name insured. A lot of times we already know that in most cases, in all cases, it will be the conference, the primary, in this case, it will be the primary policyholder. They're the ones that who are covered under the insurance policy. They have the authority to make changes, file claims, receive any benefits. And a lot of the churches in those conferences have the exact same benefits. So if they have any claims that they need to file, if they need to make changes to their statement of values, they have the same benefits that the conference does. From there, you could quickly see you have the policy number and the policy term. Policy number updates from 1 year to the next, and the policy term usually goes on an annual basis. So it'd be from January to January, February to February, so on and so forth. But when we really get into the nitty-gritty of things is where we get down to the organization name. Now, this usually is the entity itself, so it could be I don't want to name any specific churches, but it could be ABC Church, you know, and it's and that entails a lot of times the address of that location or the proper name. I want to get Brian involved a little bit more. So, Brian, I know we've had some conversation before this podcast about some instances where we've seen statement of values where the information wasn't quite correct. Could you kind of speak to that a little bit?
Sure. let's just start off kind of from the top and on the statement of values. There you have a description.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically the description of the building or the property. And one thing that I frequently see, and I should say that most of the properties that I visit are schools and academies.
Mm-hmm.
So they're properties with large facilities, many buildings, and their own administration. And they can be somewhat separated from the conference office. But a lot of times what I see as I'm going through the statement of values with the client is I'll name a building and they'll say, I wonder what that is.
Yeah.
You know, because over time, things change. Uses of buildings change. You know, something that might have been an ABC 50 years ago is now a student lounge.
Mm-hmm.
So things change and administrations change. And there are many times when the client isn't sure, or it takes us a while to try to unearth which building is listed here on the statement of values. So that's something that's important. You should review that annually. And if use has changed, if the name doesn't make sense, that can be changed. It's a simple request. And that just helps keep everybody on the same page.
Absolutely.
One other thing I'll mention real quickly as we dive here into the overall statement of values is that I find it's very helpful if facilities have site plans. Now, again, for churches, this might not be such a this isn't necessarily so important because church complexes tend to be smaller. But on your larger properties, your schools, your camps, camp meeting grounds, those type of things, it's very important to have a site plan. And a site plan, you could describe that as a map of your facility. You know, many larger properties have it. You know, something they can give their guests, and it shows them where the cafeteria is, or where the cabin is, or where the camp meeting auditorium is. But that's a good starting point. And you'll probably have to add other buildings to that site plan because you might not want everybody to know where your maintenance building is or where the wastewater treatment plant is or that type of thing. So it's great to have a site plan so that you can sit down when you review your statement of values and you can actually check off the buildings as you see them on the site plan. And that just serves as another reminder of what buildings are there. And, you know, Hunter, what happens if there's a loss to a building and it's not listed on the statement of values?
Yeah, so you bring up an excellent question, and it's a lot more, well, I won't say a lot more, but it's something that's happened a few times where either the incorrect description is there in terms of the right, you know, the building name, or even just the address. The address could be completely incorrect. In that instance, there could be the potential of some issues when it comes to claims. You know, if you have the incorrect building, it makes it difficult and a challenge to track down the proper location. Who is the actual insured? What building are we insuring? There's some ramifications on the back end of that if it's not correct. I kind of want to speak to something that you had mentioned, which was the site plan. The importance of it starts, and I kind of want to make it plain and simple for our listeners, is because that site plan is more important for more than just adding this to the policy. You know, we're laying the foundation, we're laying the building blocks. And so having that site plan is important for your statement of values so that you can ensure that you're being, have the correct insured values, you have the correct square footage. But then on the back end of things, when you start to build out your risk management plan, whether it's for fire escape or active shooter drills and things of that nature, you already have laid out the exits for those buildings and those locations. So just kind of keeping in mind that this is really important at the beginning stages, but it's something that you'll end up seeing down the road as well as you get further in depth with your strategic risk management plans at your individual entities. So I kind of want to speak again to, I know we're talking about the address, we're talking about this description in and of itself, but another common thing that gets overlooked is the square footage of locations. Brian, you're out in the field a lot, kind of getting accurate measurements of buildings and having your measuring wheel and things like that. I don't know if you want to add anything, maybe even how would someone even go about if they don't have, if they don't know what their square footage of the building is, what's something that they could do to get that information?
Well, that's an excellent question. Thank you, Hunter. And that is something we do. Hunter mentioned being in the field. That is something that I do when I visit properties, is try to verify that the square footage that is listed on the statement of values is accurate. And I'll go into that just a little bit more and answer your question here in a moment, Hunter. But, you know, I also wanted to point out that I'm sure many of you may be aware of Verisk, which is a company that we use that comes out and visits your churches and your schools, and then also our own risk control department, who visits the residential facilities like camps and academies. But we only get there every 5 years, mm-hmm. roughly. So things can happen in that time. You know, building additions can be done, new buildings can be constructed. And this summer, Hunter, there was a, as I was visiting different properties, 7 out of 9 properties that I visited consecutively had major buildings that were not listed on the statement of values. Wow. So that we're kind of backtracking a little bit, but it's easy to overlook. And in all honesty, that happened to me when I was working in camp management, completely missed a building for several years. So these things can happen. But going back to the square footage and talking about that's one thing that we verify. If you have plans for your building, that is one easy way to get the square footage if you have plans. Mm-hmm. If you don't, then the next option is to measure the building. Hunter mentioned a measuring wheel. I use a laser measure, but in general, it's the your square footage is the outside dimension of the building walls. And then you would multiply that by the number of floors in your building, and that gives you a rough idea of square footage. But you know, Hunter asked if I had any examples, you know, this summer I visited a property, and they had two very large buildings, two very large warehouses. One was 10,000 square foot, and one was 50,000 square feet. And I looked at, as I often do, I checked Google Maps, the satellite view, and looked at the property before I visited. And I looked and looked and looked, and I couldn't find this 50,000 square foot building. Mm. So when I was visiting with the client and we were going through the statement of values, I said, hey, this told them the name of the building, and this is showing at 50,000 square feet. Do you have a building that big? And they're like, oh, no, we don't think so. So I said, well, definitely want to take a look at that. I went out there and measured it. And it was 4,100 square feet, rather than 50,000. So a significant difference in square footage. And, you know, my question to you, Hunter, would be, I mean, you know, what happens if my square foot report on a building is way off like that?
Yeah, so it makes a huge, I mean, the short answer is it makes a huge difference in premium, for one. That's a start. But I know on the front end of things, if the square footage is over the amount, it's not good for you. But if it's under, I'm concerned. I would be more concerned about the under insurance of things. If your square footage is too low in comparison to what you actually have, you also mentioned just before that there's some instances where the building wasn't on the policy at all. You know, God forbid you have a total loss and you find out after the fact that this building wasn't on there at all. It wasn't listed at the correct square footage. It had the wrong address. All these things, you know, it's a matter of protecting the assets that has been entrusted to you. And I know we all, working for the church, many of us wear a lot of different hats. We tend to be busy. There's some things that we may put off a little bit longer than we intended to, just because we have other things going on. But the focus is making sure that we have as best as possible to review these documents, whether you have assistants doing it, whether you have help with the accounting from your local account executive helping you review this document consistently. Because when you have those losses, you want to make sure that you have enough coverage limits and as well as enough finances to receive, to get you, make you back whole, to make you back whole. So if you don't have those things, it could be extremely challenging. And so I think that actually offers us a, well, I think we'll have to double back a little bit because I glanced over at the document and I know there's a thing or two that we actually kind of skipped over. Someone may be watching and say, hey, well, what's this PC thing over here? So I think let's kind of touch on that. So we have PC on your statement of value, which stands for protection class. That's usually a rating anywhere from 1 to 10. And it has to do with your fire management at your local entity. So that could be inclusive of fire alarms, sprinklers, any other fire suppression equipment that you have on the individual location. That also could be inclusive of your distance from the local fire department. I know where I live, the local fire department, I can essentially walk to. So if I had a church in this location, I mean, I would have ideally a better protection class than someone who's in a more rural area where it takes the fire department maybe 20, you know, 15, 10 minutes, something like that, a lot longer to get to. I don't know if you had anything to add to that one, Brian, but I know we definitely had to touch on that one.
No, that's fine. Great. I do have a question, Hunter. Does the protection class play into the construction of my building at all? Is that part of it? You mentioned, you know, sprinkler systems, fire alarms, that sort of thing. But does it have anything to do with the type of construction of the building?
Yeah. So, I mean, the type of construction does make a difference. If you had a wood frame building, it's more likely to burn a lot faster than joist masonry building or something that's made of concrete or even has fire rated doors on the inside, or even the roof is fire rated as well. One thing that I don't believe that I mentioned and I did say that the protection class goes anywhere from 1 to 10. 1 is more on the excellent side. So if your building is that joisted masonry, has fire suppression, sprinkler system, alarm, all of that is even connected to your local fire department, you'll notice that you have a better protection class than someone who, like you said, is maybe a 10 who virtually doesn't have anything. Maybe it's an older building, wood frame, more likely to burn, doesn't have any fires, any sprinklers or things of that nature. So, That goes a long way, and that's also something that is listed on your extension of declarations is the construction type. And I know that that's a little bit more of your expertise in explaining our construction types. So if you could speak to that, and what does that look like, you know, or how would clients best even figure it out? Because and if you don't know, sometimes you could look at a building and say, hey, you know, that this looks like a wood frame, or this is, you know, I don't know, is this concrete, what is this? So
That's an excellent question, Hunter. And this is something that I deal with a lot. And I'll be honest with you, it can be challenging for me sometimes to figure out exactly what construction class a building is or construction type. But just to try to briefly break it down, and before I forget, there will be a link with this podcast to a webpage that lists the six different construction codes. It gives descriptions, it gives examples, there's pictures. So that will be a really great source for you. But just as a little background, there are six different types of construction. And basically what this means is, what are the guts of the building? What are the walls constructed of? What is the roof structure constructed of? You might have, thinking of your own home, you might have a home that's got brick on the outside, but the framing of the wall, what actually makes up the interior of the wall, is 2x4 or 2x6 wood studs. Mm-hmm. So while the building might look like a brick building on the outside, it's actually a ISO, and they refer to these as ISO classes. It's actually an ISO 1 frame building. There are some, in some instances, some of our older churches may actually have walls that are completely brick. That was a way that structures were built many years ago, and that would be a different classification. That would likely be an ISO 2 joisted masonry building. And then as far as the roof goes, since I mentioned joisted masonry, basically a joisted masonry building is a building with block or brick walls, but the roof structure is what we're always, most of us are familiar with, which would be wood trusses with a plywood deck on that, and then either shingles or some type of roofing surface. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of different, the six different construction classes, and when we visit properties, when I visit properties, we do find discrepancies from time to time, and we try to correct those. And again, Hunter, I presume that because I don't deal so much on the rating side of things, I presume, though, that the type of construction, the type of building that I have on my property would make a difference in my rates as well.
Yeah, and I can't speak too heavily to that as well, but and a lot of times it does assist in making that a better rating for a building that's joisted masonry versus a frame building, also has a better protection class than another. But then at the end of the day, which would be kind of our next topic, is your insured values. That also makes a huge difference in the premium that you end up paying and the type of condition or valuation that you have it listed as. So that gives us great opportunity to segue into more of the fun part of this document, which is the building insured limits and your building personal property insured limits as well. So it goes a little bit without saying that the building insured limits has to do with the building itself. You know, you have a 12,000 square foot building in Times Square. You imagine that building should probably be insured at a few million dollars, you know, versus maybe out in Joshua Tree, the same building, it's significantly less just due to location in and of itself. Nonetheless, the more important part of that statement is that you want to be able to have enough insured limits. It's kind of a balancing act. So a lot of times we use insurance to cover all of our loss. Sometimes if you have money set aside, then there isn't a need for insurance to cover it all. But a lot of times, even in our own personal day-to-day, we may insure my car. You know, I'll use a great example of my car. I have it insured to its full amount so that if in the event I had a total loss, I have enough money to go out and get another car. The same principles follow the building. If you have it insured at, you know, $12 million, hey, you know, worst case scenario, we're able to receive $12 million, go out, build us another beautiful church, like, kind, and quality. And I say that without getting into full detail just yet about the differences in valuations. So that's what it looks like in terms of the limits themselves. And that's for the building. Now, the personal building, personal property, the best way that I can explain it, and this is kind of how I learned it when I first came into insurance, is if you had the strength, or if you were tall enough, or God himself came down and picked up your church, flipped it upside down, shook it like a piggy bank, everything that falls off the walls, shakes, swarms all throughout the building, that is building personal property. Otherwise, if it's bolted in, if it's nailed down to the floor, if it's an actual wall or anything like that, it would be considered a part of the building. A lot of times, your insured limits of your business personal property is a percentage of the building cost. So sometimes it could be a fixed amount, it could be 30%, it could be 20%. Again, this falls heavily on the discretion of the client to make sure that everything that would be classified as business personal property meets that insured limit. So if you're talking $2.5 million and you're insuring and you're talking 30%, that's about $750K. Does that $750K cover all of our contents in the event of a total loss? So that's talking about insured limits. But I know I've mentioned it twice now, and I probably should explain a little bit more about the conditions and the valuation. So there are three main types of valuations that we use here at ARM. And the most common that we see is replacement costs. Replacement costs has to do with, if in the event that you had a total loss, this would allow you to replace and repair any property with materials of similar kind and quality. Essentially, your church burns down to the ground. In a few months to a year, you have almost the exact same church rebuilt and looks exactly the same. There are a few provisions that replacement cost allows that other valuations don't, which is recoverable depreciation. We all know that we live in a time where things are becoming a lot more expensive, and the cost of rebuild is one of those things. So, if I'm not mistaken, I'm kind of branching off a little bit, but I know in the marketplace, especially in 2022, the average cost to rebuild had increased about 14%, which is huge, and that plays a huge burden on the construction companies, contractors, but this also lends itself to come full circle and let clients know that it's important to check this document year in after year after year. Because in keeping in mind with the price of things going up, it's important to keep in mind that you're always insured you're not falling into a pit of possibly being underinsured. Especially because things are becoming a lot more expensive. One of the other two valuation classes that we deal with, one of them being actual cash value. So actual cash value is very similar to replacement costs. However, actual cash value takes into account depreciation. This reflects the property's current worth in its worn condition. So you have 15-year-old roof, you may have 30-year-old pews, you know, all of these things are taken into account when you're listed at actual cash value. And the last of which is agreed max. So you may have a facility, you know, unfortunately, there are some buildings out there, there are some churches, there are some schools where once upon a time, they were busting at the seams. They have, you know, ample congregation, a huge student body, but unfortunately those times don't currently exist. It's not to say that it won't ever get back to there, but taking into account, there may not be a need for a church as large as they currently have, or a school as large as they currently have. They may not be able to afford the premium that's associated with a building as big as theirs. And so that's when agreed max comes into account, or some instances, which we have seen, Brian, is neglected properties. Neglected, ill-maintained facilities. Agreed max makes a ton of sense. That agreed max is, hey, you know, we have this building, we still own it, we don't really want to sell it, want to kind of hold on to it, but it's not as much, it's not as valuable to us as it once was. We may not need or require $1 million if something happens to this building. Maybe 250, 500 is more than enough for us to be restored and be able to go out and do something different, but it still puts us in a place where we can maintain ministry. And so that's what agreed max looks like as well. So those are extremely important and a valuable thing to keep in mind when you're talking about insured limits and values. I don't know if I know I kind of went off on a tangent there, but I hope that was simple enough and direct that everyone could understand that one. I don't know if you had want to add anything to that, Brian.
Well, I had a question for you, Hunter. Another thing that we occasionally see on the line items of the coverage description, because that's what we're talking about here, the type of coverage description, is a business income. Yeah. What is that for?
Yeah, so in some instances, you may have, like I said, a total loss. And when you have a total loss, your property is not in use. You know, you're shut down for whatever reason. And there are still expenses that you have to account for that needs to be paid. And so business income covers that. You also have business ordinance and law, which I'm sure maybe not as many, but we do have churches out there that were built quite a while ways away, you know, a long time ago. And in that, sometimes in certain jurisdictions, they may be grandfathered in and they may not be required to make certain changes to their facility because it's more of a historical building. But for many locations, business ordinance and law follow. If you had a total loss, it's an extra limit of insurance that provides you an opportunity to bring your building or facility up to code. So if, you know, there wasn't a need for a fire escape or there wasn't a need for a sprinkler system in your facility, but now it's code, it's a requirement for your commercial property, then when you're rebuilding, it's important that you add those things. And so that's also tends to be about 10%, give or take, of the building limit, building coverage limit. So those are also things that are included as well for the client's benefit.
And business income is helpful. I know when I worked in camp ministry, there were some instances where we had losses. And, you know, when you can't use a building, you can't rent out the property. And so it's possible that business income can help in instances like that. So it's a very helpful and very important coverage that's provided.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't want to skip over this because I went through the valuations, but there's something that we actually didn't mention, which was builder's risk coverage. Now that's something that we see sometimes as well. So in the, if you're engaged in completing a new building or renovating a renovation project, the property may need to be adjusted to builder's risk coverage, which is a temporary, as long as it's under renovation or it's a new build project, it provides you coverage during that process. And it's important for you to continue to review this, update your account executive or conference once that process is completed. Unfortunately, I've seen in some instances where there are some properties that have been under builder's risk and they've been listed under that coverage type for extended period of time, even though the project may have been completed 2 or 3 years prior. If that building unfortunately had, usually in most instances, the builder's risk coverage limit is a little bit less than what the actual completed project would be. So if you ended up having a loss, there may be some challenges to figure out, well, what should the insured limits have actually been, you know? So that's one other coverage type that I think it's important for clients to keep in mind. And it's an option, you know, if you are currently having a renovation project going on, reach out to your conference or your account executive and say, hey, you know, I think we should probably be on builder's risk coverage, and then begin that process and make sure that you stay on top of it once it's completed to make those changes to either replacement costs, more than likely replacement costs.
And that's going to be for new construction as well,
yes.
Right? Not just renovations.
Yeah. That could be new construction as well. Yes.
And it's really important. I just as an example, last Thanksgiving I was at my parents' house and we went for a walk and the evening before, I guess we'd heard a lot of fire engines and wondered what happened. And the next morning we went for a walk and there was a house just down the street that had burned. Oh, and it was a brand new house, not quite, almost finished construction, but not finished construction, and had not been, nobody had inhabited it yet. And it was a complete loss.
Wow.
And that's really the importance of builder's risk, is builder's risk covers your property. And I'm using the example of new construction, but while you're building, because you don't want to invest a lot of money in this property and have something like that happen to it. It doesn't happen often.
It doesn't.
You know, and that's one of the challenges with risk management, I think, is that we always deal with the chance that something's going to happen. And a lot of times they don't, mm-hmm. but when it does, it can be a huge financial impact to your organization. And so I think builder's risk is very important to have while you're doing construction projects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's risk management is all about being proactive, you know, the off chance that something does happen. You know, a lot of times You get a bad rap and it seems like it's always, no, don't do this, don't do that, or you have to do this, you have to do that. But, you know, sometimes claims are low frequency. It may be low frequency, but the severity of these claims, even if they are low frequency, can be extremely high. And the key point and the major point and the major focus of that is avoiding mitigating, I should say, that off chance that you have a claim that exceeds the financial pot of money that you have set aside, and now you have no opportunity to rebuild. You have, that's the end of that ministry. You know, you have to start completely from scratch. So it's a protection clause, you know. And I know we work for the church, and you may not talk about it and make the correlation nearly as much, but I mean, it doesn't stray that much from the church and the principles that we practice just in our faith as a whole. So, you know, it all boils back to having that strong foundation. And that's what I, you know, someone who constantly practices it, and I don't know if you view this as well, you know, since we both work in risk management, but it offers an opportunity for you to set a strong foundation and to be able to protect your ministry and your churches and your congregation. Now that's, it doesn't get much better than that, you know. To even have that option and ability to do such a thing is amazing.
And that's why we're here. You know, we're here to we want to be able to protect your ministry, and that's, you know, that's why we look at these things in detail the way we do, because if there's a loss, we definitely want to be able to cover that loss and to restore your property back to what it was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, I don't know about you, Brian, but I think we did a good job of at least setting a foundation and giving clients an opportunity to see what it looks like going line item by line item, fully understanding what needs to be done. What am I looking for? What am I reading? You know, if I wasn't working in at ARM, I don't know if I received a statement of values, if I would even know what I'm looking at.
Well, that's a good point, Hunter. I mean, you know, because, you know, I when I worked at camp, the risk manager for the conference office would send me the statement of values every year and ask me to go over it, you know, but I didn't know what everything was, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't know what it meant. You know, we hope that this has helped you just a little bit understand the statement of values better. And if you have questions about it, you know, please contact your account executive. They can help you understand it. If you need to make changes, you can work with your conference office, with your account executive, and get the changes made.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think it's kind of a deep dive, but it's really important to understand this information, and as I said before, to review it, you know, every year. We don't come and visit the properties every year. Verisk doesn't visit the properties every year. And also, you know, take the time to read those reports. Mm-hmm. I'll mention Verisk again. You may or may not be familiar with them, but I know when I started as a risk manager at a conference, they had just gone through the Verisk reports. Mm-hmm. And so I had reports on my desk, I think, for almost 200 properties.
Yeah.
You know, but I took the time and I read through the reports and I compared those reports to the statement of values. And guess what? I found several churches that have buildings that weren't listed on the policy, you know, so those things are there. Do it, you know, do it every year, do a thorough, I know it's a lot of work, but in the long run, you know, it's about protecting the resources that God has blessed us with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself, Brian. Absolutely. Well, I think we've pretty much covered the statement of value. We're just shy of kind of doing a deep dive into the policy after that. But I want to thank all of our listeners, and thank you, Brian, for sitting and having this conversation. I hope that we were able to provide you with great information and detail. Again, if you have any follow-up questions, you can reach out to your account executive. Feel free to even reach out to risk control department. We're here, we're more on the risk management side, but this is exactly what we do. Verisk is a great resource. I do want to reiterate what you mentioned, Brian, about having those Verisk reports. They do provide great estimates if you're unsure about your insured values, at least for the building side of things. It gives you a good place to start. You know, it gives you a good estimate of what that looks like. Again, thank everybody for joining. This has been Let's Talk Solutions. Again, my name is Hunter Pettis, and this is also Brian Schwab. Thank you again for joining us. And until next time.
Bye-bye.
I hope you found our podcast today informative and that you are equipped for your ministry in a new way. Please don't forget to share the podcast with your friends and fellow ministry leaders. That helps get our information to the people who need it most. As always, we would love to see your feedback and suggestions on our social media channels. God bless, and see you next time.